But now on Radio 4, The Last Great Wilderness, the second of Andrew Luck Baker's exploration into forest canopies, the richest but least known habitats on Earth, high amongst the treetops. What role for these so-called lungs of the Earth in future climate change?
You're in.
Okay.
Got your helmet on, good. Everything done up.
Well, I'm totally bewildered by all these different ropes and harnesses and clips you're filling me up with.
No, it'll all fall into place.
It's a bit of a palaver getting ready to scale a 70-foot tree, especially if you're a novice at these things. But the climb is worth it. You enter the planet's most biologically rich and dynamic habitats, the forest canopy.
The canopy is this incredibly vibrant part of the forest. It's where all the interesting things are happening. It's where trees pass their genes around through pollination. It's where all the fruit is as well. And it's where all these leaves are acting like solar panels, soaking up the sun's energy and taking up carbon dioxide. All this sort of stuff is going on in abundance in the canopy, but it's so hard to study because it's so hard to get up there.
I climbed a few trees in Borneo recently that were pushing 90 metres, and that takes you 45, 50 minutes continuous climbing.
Wow.
Straight up.
Right. Well, shall we head on up there?
High in the treetops, biologists have spent many years trying to count the extraordinary number of animal and plant species making the canopies their home. But as we'll hear, more recently, their concerns also been turning to the two-way relationship between the planet's swathes of forest and the changing global atmosphere. At the heart of this connection lies photosynthesis, where trees take carbon dioxide out of the air, water out of the ground, and with the energy from sunlight, combine the two to make solid organic matter, the stuff of wood and trees. But as we humans are adding ever more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere through our fossil fuel burning, there are big question marks over how the forests will cope with that. It could be the trees might take some of the heat out of global warming, or they might make climate change that much worse. Whichever, our messing with the atmosphere is going to change forests all over the world. To find out how, researchers have to get to the canopies.
Lift your foot again.
Give me some slack on the rope.
That's it. So this is it. This is the inchworming process. Whoops. You can take it as fast or as slow as you like, basically.
My climbing supervisor, James Aldred, made it look easy. But even for pros like James and forest researcher Andrew Mitchell, who was inching up this tree in Oxfordshire's Whiteham Woods a lot quicker than I was, getting up and around the canopy by rope is a time-consuming business.
Dangling around on ropes like we are at the moment is an inherently dangerous business.
Well, it certainly felt it all the way up here.
And, you know, this system is very safe, but, you know, canopy science is dangerous science.
What's driven biologists up here?
About 40% of all life on Earth exists up in the forest canopy. That's a good reason to go there, to find out about life on Earth. But there's perhaps a more important reason, and that is because the forest canopy is where life meets the atmosphere. It's the primary interface between about 90% of the global biomass, that's all the living material on Earth, with the atmosphere. So the impact of climate change is going to be beating down on the canopy where all that life is over the next few decades, and we want to know how it's going to change the way forests work.
The reliance on rope has restricted the investigations into these globally important matters, but things are looking up, so to speak. Andrew Mitchell runs the Global Canopy Programme, which has proposed that Whiteham Woods be one of several sites around the world for a high-tech canopy observatory centred around a giant crane. It would join 9 existing research cranes scattered in forests in countries such as Panama, Australia and Switzerland.
These cranes are the same cranes that we see all around us in towns that are building tower blocks and things like this. And the wonderful thing about a crane is that you can just send the basket down to the ground, step into it, put in all your equipment and just say, beam me up, Scotty. And they take you up into the canopy and you can reach over a whole hectare of forest, far more than you can get to with these ropes like we're using here. And you can go to that particular flower the next day, the next week, throughout the year. No other system can do that. So cranes are going to transform the way in which we understand the way our forests work.
Just go down, you see the crane now emerging through the canopy under the leaves. It's a 45 meter tall building crane with a gondola on it, and the crane permits us to freely move in an area of 2,500 square meters of forest. Within minutes we can go to any of these trees like if we were moving in a garden.
This is Swiss ecologist Christian Kerner. A few miles from the city of Basel, his crane stands aloft a typical Western European broadleaf forest, with a mix of oak, lime, beech and so on, you might see anywhere from Switzerland to the British Isles. In this wood, Professor Kerner runs the most ambitious of canopy crane experiments. It centres around subjecting some of the trees here to the kind of atmosphere predicted for the middle of this century. The interest is how our rising carbon dioxide emissions might affect tree growth in the future. Some scientists reckon the world's trees might in fact slow down the rate of global warming by taking in a good proportion of the greenhouse gas we're responsible for and storing it in their wood out of harm's way.
Because trees take up carbon dioxide during photosynthesis for their own life and they need a lot, people have built up the idea that they might do more of this in a CO2-rich future. We know that with carbon dioxide you can stimulate plant photosynthesis. This is everyday practice in greenhouse cropping. For instance, if you buy tomatoes out of season, they come from a greenhouse and the greenhouse needs to be heated, and as a byproduct of the heating, carbon dioxide is produced, and gardeners and horticulturists, they are releasing clean carbon dioxide into the greenhouse and have a 30% higher yield in tomato.
So CO2 in this case, in the case of the tomatoes, is acting as a sort of a fertilizer.
Well, you could treat it as a type of fertilizer. So rightfully people have been started to think whether the same thing would apply to a forest. The question is whether they take up more if we provide more. If they would, one could further assume that they also would grow more. And if they would grow more, the storage in the forest could be bigger. That's it. Door to open.
Okay, so it was into the crane's hanging basket or gondola to see how the future atmosphere around the trees is engineered. Only with a crane can you install the technology to do this sort of experiment on a mature woodland. As it lifted us higher and higher, the sheer ambition of this experiment became obvious.
Excellent, and we're climbing the trunks of these trees, and we're getting closer and closer to the canopy top. Wonderful.
15 meters above ground. And you see really how the canopy changes. In the lower parts of the canopy, all the leaves are more horizontal and dark green, while in the top, leaves are much smaller. Now we are at 25 meters above ground. And now you will hear a short bump. This is when we stop the crane, when the engine stops.
There's all the bump.
This was the pump, yeah. Here, this is really where everything happens. This is where the photosynthetic machinery is packed up. So if we want to understand how these trees might respond to a greater carbon dioxide supply in the future, we need to work up here.
And how do you do it then? I mean, how do you raise the carbon dioxide levels of the environment here, the air here?
Right, this was the main challenge. Weaving tubes, as you see here, loosely into the trees. It looks like a Christmas tree decoration, but it's black tubing and it's made for drip irrigation. And they have punched these tubes with a laser so that through these tiny holes we release carbon dioxide that comes from a big tank under high pressure. So tiny little jets are emerging here and are mixing up with the free atmosphere.
So Christian, just in this tree that we're hovering by at the moment alone, there seems to be an awful lot of this tubing entwined around the branches. I mean, for the whole site, how much tubing is involved here?
A lot. We have about 12 kilometers of tubes wrapped around the crowns of 12 tall trees. The whole area is 500 square meters that we have under CO2 enrichment. We cannot claim we have 100% control, but nobody doing this sort of experiment anywhere could claim this, but we are close to, say, between 80 and 90% of control of the daytime.
Last year, the findings from the first 4 years of the experiment were published in the journal Science. They didn't offer much hope that trees in temperate forests like this one will help to mop up our carbon dioxide emissions and take some of the heat out of global warming in decades to come. Although beech trees showed early promise.
The growth rings were substantially wider in beech in the first season they received enriched CO2.
What? They responded quite
well. Oh, yeah, they did. They took a big, we got it, yeah. And then, in a simple way, I guess they noticed they don't have all the other elements they need to make something useful out of that big amount of carbon they took up in the first place. So they slowed down rapidly, and after this, in the second year, they were already back almost to normality. and by the year 4 it was gone, the signal, completely gone. But neither oak, no hornbeam, no lime, no cherry, no maple, none of these other species showed any response even in the first year and continued to do so to the very time we're here.
So, as you say, like nutrients in the soil, there's got to be, you know, an extra input, if you like, of all those nutrients for them to take proper advantage of that extra carbon.
Well, this is the best explanation we have to date, but we saw a number of other changes within those trees. For instance, against our expectation, photosynthesis did not downtune. So photosynthesis actually made a profit. These trees took up more carbon dioxide, despite the trunk didn't show any growth, so the obvious question is, so where is it going? If leaves suck up more CO2 from the atmosphere, but then the products are not invested in more stem growth, where is it going?
So they were actually producing, say, more sugars, for example.
Yes, they produced more sugar, and in the oak trees we found also more starch in the leaves accumulating, but eventually they cannot pack up more and more and more in the canopy, they have to get rid of it, so it must be transported down through the branches, through the main stems, to the roots, and somehow it must leave the system. Where is it going? In the forest floor. The forest floor has lots of secrets, and we are only lifting a few of them. And so the soils is now the only way where we can envisage some of this being left.
On our way down, Christian told me that the latest evidence suggests the surplus carbon in the form of sugars is used as food by fungi, which live in a symbiotic relationship with the tree's roots. When the fungi consume the sugars, the extra carbon is pumped as carbon dioxide gas straight back into the atmosphere.
Okay, back to us.
Very gentle landing. Canopy scientists in other parts of the world are now keen to know how their forests will respond to future CO2 levels. Will tropical canopies, for instance, act the same way?
Whoop.
That was a nice bumpy one. It's liftoff towards the treetops of the Daintree rainforest in northeast Australia. A very different kind of canopy comes into view as we rise. Many more species, including tropical gum trees and exotic-looking palms. Some of the scientists work on measuring the great biodiversity of all living things up here, but others are focused on the interactions of the forest with the atmosphere. Environmental chemist Michael Liddell would like to try something like the Swiss experiment.
It's a little more difficult to do it here than it is in Switzerland. The logistics of shipping vast tons of carbon dioxide from way down south in Australia to Cape Tribulation are rather challenging.
So do you think it's going to happen, or logistics is going to get in the way?
We're planning it. Last year I studied the wind characteristics of the site and made sure that the site is quite suitable for doing this sort of study. And there's a great deal of interest in doing it because it has not been done in a tropical forest at all. The field conditions here are so different to a temperate zone. We're under hot conditions. This is a seasonal tropic, so it's hot and wet in the season that you've come to visit, but then it's warm and very dry for a large part of the year. So now it's very hard to predict exactly what's going to go on here. You need to do the measurements.
There are certainly many more kinds of tree to monitor, and it's not just trees which make up this canopy. Nigel Stork, the chief scientist at the Daintree Canopy Crane, drew my attention to the rampant vines festooning many of the trees.
Everywhere you look, it's different.
Here you've got several species of vines that are climbing up the single tree, and in fact you can't see the tree underneath it now. It's just totally dominating. Then in a storm it could bring that whole tree down, and then the whole cycle of life starts again. And most forests are like this. Most tropical forests, you have this massive competition that's going on.
It's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon now, so I guess it's getting about as hot as it gets, isn't it?
Yeah, because the sun's right above us. Probably 33 or 34 degrees.
And that's in the shade, of course, isn't it? So
yes.
It's actually directly in the sun.
Yeah.
It's baking.
This time of day, around the middle of the day, the forest will be at peak fixation rate, trapping the carbon into its structure, making sugars, making wood. The whole day and the whole night, the forest is also releasing carbon dioxide. So what we see during the day is actually more of fixation of carbon dioxide than respiration, this breathing process. At the night, the only thing we see is the respiration, the breathing process. So when we look at the balance between the photosynthesis and the respiration, if they balance out completely, we're calling it a carbon neutral forest. If there's more photosynthesis than respiration, then we're actually fixing carbon into the forest, and then we call the forest a carbon sink.
Most of the world's forests today are either carbon neutral on balance or act as slight carbon sinks, taking a little more carbon dioxide out of the air than they put back in. The global tonnage of carbon they currently store in wood is colossal. There's as much carbon held in the forests as there is in the whole atmosphere. Now, the big worry is that climate change is going to shift the balance of carbon in and carbon out in the out direction and cause an awful lot of carbon dioxide to be added to the atmosphere, helping to fuel global warming. At the Daintree Forest, Michael Liddell is taking various measurements to keep tabs on the carbon account of this ecosystem, using a range of monitors permanently fixed to the crane tower.
That spiky-looking device that's measuring the wind directions and the wind velocities in three dimensions. And that rather small white cylinder on the left-hand side with some glass windows in it, that's actually the instrument that measures the concentration of carbon dioxide in water. It does that by shining a light beam through the air, and any carbon dioxide molecule that's in that light beam then absorbs the infrared radiation.
How is the canopy behaving then? Are you getting more carbon dioxide on balance going into the forest or coming out?
Last year seems to have been a relatively normal year, and the very first year that we studied seemed to be relatively normal years, in that we have the forest behaving as a slight sink for carbon. And then after that, in subsequent years, 2002, 2003, very big droughts came through this region, once in 40-year droughts, and there was one after the other. That reduced the amount of water that was available to the plants, and the plants then selectively shut down their photosynthesis. So the forest actually switched over to becoming a slight source of carbon dioxide at the end of 2003.
Why did the drought have that effect?
Well, the plants were extremely stressed. We have an enormous amount of leaf loss from the trees. So the result of that is that they chose to shut down their photosynthesis, fixing carbon, but they still had to keep the respiration going. So that's why we saw the forest behaving as a source for carbon dioxide.
I mean, have you any idea what the future has in store for this forest?
Yeah, the future is not looking all that great for this region, with greenhouse models for this particular region expecting the area to be hotter and there to be less water available for the plants to use. So exactly the sort of scenario that I was just talking about is likely to become the norm for this forested region.
And what are the relevance of this discovery to forests elsewhere, such as the Amazon forest, by far the largest tropical forest on the planet? The climate scientists who use computers to model how rising carbon dioxide levels are likely to affect climate patterns in the future believe it's very likely this region too is going to get a lot less rain over the next 50 years.
It's a very significant finding if it pertains to the Amazon, because if the same thing happens in the Amazonian forest and they get placed into drier, hotter conditions, then for at least a short amount of time there's going to be a very large amount of carbon dioxide coming out of the Amazonian forest, and that will change the greenhouse picture quite substantially.
So the carbon that is not taken up by the Amazon forest that now currently is, well, this could be a kind of extra fuel
this will be
to
a feedback.
Climate change.
Yes, exactly. The modellers are looking at various feedback mechanisms at the moment, and they're now becoming increasingly concerned about the fact that they can't actually ignore the biology in their models too much anymore, and they must actually respect the fact that the forests are going to respond to these big changes in climates.
The degree of extra warming and global climate change from this vicious cycle effect is something that climate modellers are now grappling to quantify. Diminishing rainfall won't only affect a forest's carbon balance. Less water is also likely to change which plant species do well there. The whole character and biodiversity of a forest might change dramatically. Suspended by the crane over a particularly action-packed section of the canopy, plant physiologist Peter Franks told me what he expected for the Daintree Forest.
We certainly might see quite an obvious difference if we come up in the canopy crane again in 10 years' time. One of the major components of this forest, as you can see, are woody vines. Woody vines are quite abundant in lowland tropical rainforest because usually the conditions are wet and warm enough for these types of plants to thrive. But woody vines don't do so well under dry conditions. They're less efficient at using water and they're more susceptible to having problems with their plumbing. So if conditions do in fact become drier in this forest, we will see a marked decline in the presence of these vine species that now you can see are quite dominant in the canopy. But the balance could very well shift in the near future with a change in the levels of rainfall that we're receiving here.
The competitive edge some species have over others could also be shifted by the atmospheric change underlying these predicted temperature and rainfall changes for the future. In other words, a direct effect of the steadily rising level of carbon dioxide from all our fossil fuel burning. It's back to the deciduous forest in Switzerland, where the researchers from the University of Basel are bathing a variety of trees in year 2050 levels of the greenhouse gas. As well as studying the effect of this on the tree's growth, plant physiologist Sonja Kiel is also monitoring its impact on the tree's ability to manage their water budgets. This involves taking detailed measurements from the soil to individual leaves. The leaves are key to this story because of pores on their surfaces, through which they take in carbon dioxide and let out water vapor.
Leaves have a lot of pores on the underside of the leaf to take up the carbon dioxide. So they open these pores during the day and take up the carbon dioxide, but at the same time they lose water vapor. They cannot help it, they just lose it because they open the pores. And now
So water evaporates sort of out of the leaf tissue and into the air through these holes,
exactly,
these pores.
Yes. And because now the CO2 concentration is increased, we assume or we hypothesize that the stomates will close a little bit. So they would reduce the stomal opening to still take up enough carbon dioxide, but at the same time they can reduce the water loss.
So the reasons why they could close their stomata, their pores then, is because the concentration is that much higher in the air, so they don't actually need to have their pores open for so long, so big.
Yes, because plants are always sort of in a conflict between starving, meaning not taking up enough carbon dioxide, and
dehydrating,
exactly. So these stomates sort of control these two opposing processes.
How do you make these measurements? If these pores, these stomata, are very, very tiny, I'm presuming you can only see them through a microscope, is that right?
Yes, that's right, they're tiny. And what we do is actually we clamp a tiny chamber to the leaf, then we actually measure the relative humidity in this small cuvette. And as soon as we clamp this cuvette to the leaf, the humidity will increase because water vapor is lost through these pores. And we just measure the time for the relative humidity to increase by a certain amount, and then we sort of back calculate the opening of these stomatas. And what we found is that species responded differently to this elevated carbon dioxide concentrations, and only stomates of hornbeam reduce their openings and reduce the water loss, whereas beech and oak, they didn't respond at all.
So in a CO2-rich atmosphere, if one tree starts to save water and the other one doesn't, so you have losers and winners, and this is exactly what we find here. Had we not this mix, had we had, for instance, if we just had hornbeam here, we would write an article for a scientific journal saying, oh, that forest trees save a lot of water in a future CO2-rich world. And now we have also oak and we have also beech, and both of them apparently didn't read the textbook. They simply don't do what we all had expected. So you have this different strategy in the same forest canopy. And I think this is very exciting. It shows really that biodiversity is not just an esoteric thing or an ethical thing or a conservation thing. It really has function. It matters which type of tree you have in a landscape, in a catchment.
I mean, might that put oak trees or beech trees, say, in a forest where there's also hornbeam, at a competitive disadvantage then,
exactly,
possibly as the CO2 rises,
right,
in a bad year for rain?
Right, this is what we would conclude from this. Wherever trees are sharing a same environment, these biodiversity effects are likely to be underway right now, because we are already 30% above the pre-industrial CO2 concentrations. So these are not just things that are in a far distant future, they're happening right now already.
As director of the Global Canopy Programme, Andrew Mitchell shares a sense of urgency. To get a fuller global understanding of the multitude of interactions between forests and the changing atmosphere, he's trying to raise the funds to expand the current network of canopy cranes.
In the tropics, there are proposals for Brazil, Ghana, Madagascar and India. Wyatt and Woods in Oxfordshire is a natural choice for a British forest observatory. The woods have been the focus of intense ecological study for 50 years. But installing a crane would launch a new era of research here. There are many pressing questions to be answered.
We want to look at the climate and the ecophysiology and all of that side, but also the animals and the plants and the ecology of how the forest functions, right down from leaf tip to root tip at each site. We could start from our position where we are here, up in the canopy of a beech tree in southern England. If you look at the models, it's kind of a, putting it simply, a toss-up, whether southern Britain will be like the Loire or Corsica in around about 2050. And trees like this old beech tree here could be under severe stress. They could even vanish from southern Britain. Now, how can we test that to find out how it will happen? Well, the way to do it would be to use the crane to wire up the forest with every kind of instrument we want, to look at the biodiversity, how will that change, to look at the leaves, how they will change, the hydrology, water going up from soil to leaf, and even under the soil itself, to look at the root tips. All of that will be investigated, and then we will drought about half the plot, which means we stop rainfall getting to the roots by putting Perspex covers over it. And we'll be able to mimic roughly the worst drought that's happened in southern England since about 1756, because we've got rainfall data at Oxford going back that far.
So, and you need to have your measurements from the leaf tips down to the very ends of the roots.
Well, ultimately what you're looking for is the tipping point. At what point does the ecosystem begin to go into collapse? Does you first see the signs down in the roots, or can we pick it up in the leaves that are curling and going brown? How will the insect communities change? Do we suddenly see the potential for a pest outbreak that might cause wide-ranging damage because the trees are stressed and can't cope with it? These are the sort of tipping points we want to look for. And ultimately what you're trying to decide is who are the winners and who are the losers? What ultimately this sort of research will lead to is answering very simple questions. If you want to create a woodland on your farm, or plant trees in your garden, or advice for, say, something like the Forestry Commission, what should we be planting in southern England? Life is all about change. It doesn't stay the same over time, but we have to learn to live with it and manage it.
There are, of course, uncertainties about just how bad global warming is going to get. But all the scientists we heard from in this program agreed that forests are going to respond dramatically in parts of the world. We need to know how, so we can plan for their future and our own. Ecology isn't one of those disciplines with a tradition of multi-million pound big science projects. But Nigel Stork argues we'll better deal with the environmental challenges ahead with more research cranes, like the one standing in the Daintree rainforest.
So for one of the few places on Earth, we're actually getting a real understanding of what's actually happening to this forest at any one point in time. You build that up over 2 or 3 years, 4 years, and you've got the climatic data, which we're recording all the time from the crane here as well. We're going to really start to understand how these things are interacting in a way that no one's done before.
The Last Great Wilderness was presented by Andrew Luck Baker and produced by Adrian Washburn.